Accession number 16254, Reel 1.
Commander Lamb, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born at Aldborough in Suffolk.
Which year was this?
Which what?
Which year was this?
This was 1923.
What did your father do for a living?
My father was a buyer with Maples, which was big, well, which still is a big furnishing store in London.
Did you go to school in Aldborough?
No, I went to University College School at Hampstead in London.
And how old were you when you finished your schooling?
Well, that was due to the war. I was 16 and a half, 17.
Did you have any reaction in September 1939 when you heard the news that we had declared war on Germany?
Yes, I was a schoolboy and I was very thrilled.
Wasn't there any sense of dismay at all?
I don't think so, no. I think, naturally being young, you look forward to excitement.
Were you in any of the early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
We lived at Arkley, which was near Barnet at that time. So we were in the bombing which took place in and around London, but we were more on the outskirts of the city, so we didn't really suffer any major damage.
Did any bombs at all fall in the Arkley-Barnet area?
Oh, certainly, yes. But the biggest thing was the shrapnel which we used to get coming down from the anti-aircraft guns, which were ranged around the City of London, and we had a detachment very close to Arkley, which was very exciting when you're young.
Do you remember any specific bombs that fell?
Yes.
Can you describe any?
Well, they were mostly at night, and the nearest one was, I think, at Radlett, where I cycled over to have a look in the morning, but it had been fallen in the countryside, so there was no great damage.
Did anybody fall casualty in the area, do you think?
Not that I knew of.
Any particular buildings or streets that were hit that you remember?
There was quite a number around Temple Fortune. That's where my future wife came from, and she suffered more as a child than I think we suffered in Arkley, being slightly further from the City of London.
What was the morale of the public like during the bombing?
Stoical and determined to grin and bear it, I think is the best way to describe it.
How did you come to be in the forces yourself?
Well, I wanted to fly ever since I was young, and as soon as I was old enough, I volunteered for the Fleet Air Arm. That was in 1940, but I had to wait a year before I could get in, and during that period I studied advertising.
And when you joined the Navy, can you tell me about the pattern of your training, please?
Yes. First of all, we reported to Leon Solent, and from there we went to Gosport, St. Vincent, which is a naval establishment where we did square bashing for the best part of 8 weeks under a very famous Chief Petty Officer called Chief Petty Officer Wilmot, who was renowned throughout everybody in the Fleet Air Arm as a disciplinarian. And when we completed our square bashing at St. Vincent, we were selected either for training on fighters in the United States or for torpedo bomber reconnaissance, where the training was in England. I was one of the fortunate few who were selected for fighters and then went to the United States via Canada. We sailed from Liverpool and arrived in New York after a 16-day crossing on a United States ship called the USS Neville. From New York, we went up to Moncton in Canada by train, and Moncton that time was a holding unit for both the RAF and the fleet Huron. We were there during the snow for about 3 weeks, and then we went by train to Gros Isle in Detroit, where we started our primary training.
What did you... This is 1942, by the way.
This is 1942.
What did you think of the quality of training that you got in America?
I thought it was excellent. It is rather interesting to note that when we were due to leave this country, we were in plain clothes, because America at that time was not in the war. But during this period, while the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, we changed back into uniform, and all our training in the States was then, from then onwards, done in uniform. The primary training was carried out on biplanes, which were called the MP1, and then on to the Stearman. And at the end of the primary training, we went south to Pensacola, where the second part of our training took place. In Pensacola, we converted onto Harvards and were there approximately 2 to 3 months, doing fighter combat, air-to-air firing, and everything at that time which was to make a useful fighter pilot. After Pensacola, we went south to Miami, to Opa-locka Airfield, and it was at Opa-locka that we eventually graduated onto the Booster Buffalo, which was notorious for its engine failures at that time. These were Buffaloes which had been used to train United States personnel and were very prone to engine failure and oil leaks, and there were numerous occasions when these Buffaloes put down in the Everglades in the swamp area of Florida, and we had to go out in the swamp buggy and rescue the unfortunate pilot, who usually ditched quite successfully in the Everglades.
What about the... Was it the U.S. Navy who were training you?
Yes, the U.S. Navy.
What about the relations with them and their discipline as compared with that of the Royal Navy?
We found that their discipline rather petty in a way. Some of the punishments were for malpractice. Well, a typical example was you were given an area in the hangar to sweep up a load of peas with a toothbrush. Running around the airfield 5 times carrying full kit. It's rather hard to differentiate between the discipline in the Navy and the discipline in the United States Navy, but the general feeling amongst us at that time was it was petty compared with what one would expect in the Royal Navy.
Were you punished yourself?
Oh, yes.
What for?
Oh, it's a long time ago now. I think mainly for breaking leave or not being back on time, or minor offences of that nature.
Did you have to sweep peas up with a
toothbrush? Oh, yes, yes.
And what about relations with the U.S. civilians, if there were...
Oh, it was tremendous. When we had a day off, we used to usually fly for 7 days and have the 8th day off, so that the day off was not always on a weekend. And when we used to go outside the gates, there were people waiting for us in cars to take us to their homes and welcome us with open arms and... especially at times like Thanksgiving or any of the national holidays in America. We had many girlfriends out there, and families with whom, in point of fact, I still correspond.
Did the Americans seem to see eye to eye with the British as regards the conduct of the war from your conversations with them?
Yes, we were literally fated over there. It was about that time that the film In Which We Serve came out, and I came out of a cinema, by which time I'd been commissioned in Miami as a midshipman, and I was welcomed by elderly ladies who almost cried when they saw me and said, oh, what you must have gone through in the war before we joined. And then we were taken home and given sumptuous meals, entertained royally, and driven back to the station late at night to carry on with our final bit of training before returning to the United Kingdom.
Now, returning to Britain, can you tell me about the first operations you got involved in, please, and which unit you were with?
Yes, when I returned to Britain, I'd obviously trained on American aircraft, and the first thing we did was to go to Yeovilton to convert onto British aircraft. And at that time, we converted onto the CFAR and the Sea Hurricane. Our initial deck landings were done on the Sea Hurricane, and that was done off Lamlash in the north of Scotland, which were fraught with danger because the Sea Hurricane at that time was not a particularly good aircraft for deck landing, insofar as it had very much of a bounce capability on the deck, and a hook which was halfway down the fuselage. And it was a case of rather luck or joss if you engaged the wire you were aiming for on the deck. We lost quite a few pilots doing the initial deck landings on Hurricanes, two to my knowledge. But at any rate, after we'd survived that ordeal, we converted to CFARs, Mark 1, I think, at that time. It may have been the L2C, it was the Mark 1. And carried out our first night flying at Yeovilton. And this was quite a difference from night flying in the United States, where there was brilliant lights and townships all lit up, and to fly at night over a completely darkened England was really night flying. And we took us a long time to get accustomed to the inky blackness of the English countryside after the lighted area of Florida and the townships there where we had done our initial training in night flying.
Which squadron did you go into?
My first squadron was 808 Squadron, which I joined at Turnhouse, that's just outside Edinburgh. Then we moved down to Andover, which was a grass strip, and it was from Andover that we embarked in HMS Battler to take us to the Mediterranean. Our first job was a Gibraltar convoy, which took us 8 days from Glasgow to Gibraltar. That was quite quiet. Then we did a Malta convoy, where our senior pilot, Peter Constable, who unfortunately later was killed, shot down a JU-88 in the evening dusk, which was shadowing us.
Did you see him do it?
No, it was out of sight of the ship, only just out of sight, but we were listening to the RT reports coming in, and then we went to the debriefing and got all the factual details at that time. there were two of them, he and his number two, and the JU-88 fell in the water. I think the German pilot was later picked up by one of the attendant destroyers. I'm not certain of that, because in wartime you never know quite what happens after the event. From there we went to Malta. When we arrived in Malta, it was very much bombed, and we had a short time in Grand Harbour before we sailed for the invasion of Salerno on September the 15th, 1943. The Salerno invasion was rather a catastrophe from the point of view of the Fleet Air Arm, insofar as we had a fleet of 8 escort carriers, the major speed of which was 18 knots. There was absolutely no wind at all for the whole 5 days of the operation, so that the wind speed over the deck was 18.5 knots. The minimum speed we needed for landing the seafarers on the deck was 25 knots. Consequently, seafarers were coming in, catching wires, pulling out their arrestor hooks with the increased landing speed and hitting the barriers. Those that didn't catch the arrestor wires went into the barriers, and many were catapulted over the side. During the Salerno operation, we had 24 aircraft in our ship, and after the fourth day, there were only 4 aircraft available for the operation. In our ship, we lost 4 pilots due entirely to deck landing accidents.
What happened to you personally?
I was one of the lucky ones. I survived, and I think I flew something like 8 to 10 sorties during that operation.
Can you describe what happened on your sorties, please?
Yes. We were supposed to give the combat air patrol over the Bay of Salerno and be directed by the fighter direction ship, if required, onto any targets onshore which were creating a resistance. We were directed onto 3 targets, which at that time we employed with 303 fire. This is before the days of the mounted cannons in the seafire, and before the days of the rockets. Most of our targets were trucks retreating before in ahead of the invading force. There was, when we secured a landing strip there, which was on the fourth day, the remaining 4 aircraft were flown from the ship to the landing strip, and they then operated from the landing strip for the final day of the operation. The landing strip was in a vineyard, fairly small, and I think it was called, it was Monte Corvino or something of that nature. I don't want to get it muddled up with the monastery, but it was a very similar name to the famous monastery which was later created to do resistance to the advancing American forces. I was not one of those chosen of the 4 to go ashore, so my operation in Salerno virtually finished on the fourth day.
So you were operating mainly against soft-backed vehicles?
Yes, yes. We didn't engage any tanks or armoured vehicles during that period. I personally did not, and I don't think any of the other ships did either. Well, pilots from the other ships did either. The fleet at that time was roughly 15 miles offshore, and the fighter direction ship was about 7 miles offshore, and they were the responsibility for directing us onto their various targets. And they were the fighter direction ship had the what we call the sea balls, the carrier-borne army liaison officers aboard, who were familiar with the army problems ashore, and they relayed the various targets required to be taken out for by the attacking forces.
How much success do you think you personally had against those targets?
I think we were quite successful against the targets, but one must weigh up the cost of lost aircraft and lost pilots at that time against the strike effect against those targets.
Was it easy to find the targets?
Oh yes, we were directed onto the targets. We were given map references, left or right, and we could usually see them quite clearly. The visibility was excellent at Salerno.
So they weren't heavily camouflaged?
No, they were retreating at the time, most of them.
What about opposition in terms of flak or enemy aircraft?
There was some opposition. One of the other flights from Stalker, the CO, I've got his name now, shot down an ME-109, but the air opposition was minimal. This was a flight of ME-109s we later found were being flown from a base in around the Aegean back towards Germany, and just happened to cross the area, and they weren't part of the defending force at Salerno. The flak, well, I had nothing to compare it by at that time, but it was not as heavy as we experienced later in the Southern France invasion.
Was the Battler attacked?
No, none of the ships were attacked. They were screened by the destroyers roughly 15 miles offshore.
What was your personal reaction to being on operations for the first time?
Looking back, there was a certain fear and nervousness before the flight, but once you were airborne and on the job, it disappeared, and afterwards there was a tremendous elation.
So that was your first time in action at Salerno?
Yes.
What happened to you after Salerno?
After Salerno, we returned to the United Kingdom. We had Christmas at home, and then I joined 807 Squadron, which was a 24-pilot squadron, as opposed to a 12-pilot squadron, which we had in 808. We had a workup at Longkesh in Ireland, now the famous prison camp, and converted onto the CFIRE L2Cs, which had the cannon and rockets. A lot of our workup period was getting used to firing, cannon firing and rocket firing on targets in Loch Ness and off the Northern Irish coast. From Longkesh, we embarked in HMS Hunter, similar ship to HMS Battler. These were all escort carriers, most of them built at Pascagoula in the United States. Flat tops, the maximum capacity of 24 aircraft, small ships, and they used to roll tremendously in rough seas. Hunter then sailed for the Mediterranean, and we went straight to Malta. By this time, of course, North Africa had been secured entirely, and convoys sailed fairly freely from Gib through the Mediterranean to Malta.
What did you think of having the cannon and rockets instead of the 303?
We thought it was a tremendous improvement. The rockets for the ground attack, which was, because we were fighter ground attack, we weren't solely fighter. It was a combined air cover and strike capability that we had at that time. And the rockets were very, very successful, as we found out later, in the south of France and various places like that. Although they weren't used very much at that time, because they were a complete new innovation, we relied far more on the cannons for strike effect.
Sorry, I interrupted your narrative with you arriving in the Mediterranean, please.
Yes. Well, when we got to Malta, we had a short time at Malta, in Califana Bay, and then we sailed after various exercises on the North African coast for the invasion of southern France, which, if I remember rightly, was August the 15th, 1944. Here again, we had two carrier forces, eight escort carriers, and I believe, if I remember rightly, there was one fleet carrier, although I can't remember which one. It's a long time ago, and I'm digging into my memory as hard as I can. The invasion of southern France was, I think, much easier operation as regards carrier capability and less accidents on the carrier deck than Salerno. This was for two reasons. One, the sea fires by this time had been radically improved. They had a sting-type hook at the rear end, as opposed to a fuselage hook, which hang well down below the aircraft for engaging the wires. The new long-stroke oleos had been incorporated on the wheels, and this, of course, reduced the likelihood of bounce on a pitching deck, so that there were far less deck landing accidents, and during the Southern France operation we did have reasonable natural wind, which gave us the required 25 knots or so over the deck we needed for the deck landing. The Southern France operation was, from our point of view, mainly ground attack, striking at various targets, such as